Domenico Mondugno's Volare. Isn't it a damn catchy song? I mean, it's so damn catchy that it's been in my head all frickin' week. And I couldn't tell you what the Italian lyrics were, even if you held a gun to my head. Chances are, neither could Dean Martin. I mean, he later covered the tune for American audiences, and who knows what kind of Italian lessons he had. And that's just it, really. I mean, when a song, or for the purposes of this podcast, a book, gets translated, how do you retain the original magic of the song without compromising the meaning of the language? Does something get lost in the translation? How do translators negotiate these tricky questions? And how many other songs, or books, out there are as rockin' as Volare, and we don't possibly know a damn thing about them? Well, I talked with Michael Orthofer about these questions because they directly concerned his LitBlog Co-op nomination.
So I am here with the one, the only, Michael Orthofer of the Complete Review, the Literary Saloon, who has nominated White Spirit, I believe. Is that correct, Michael?
That's correct. White Spirit by Paula Constant.
Yes, thank you so much. Translated by Betsy Wing. It's coming back to me. How are you doing, Michael? And what was it about this book that struck your fancy that made it an LBC nominee?
Obviously, the book itself immediately struck my fancy. I actually like the opening scene very much, the interaction between Victor and his grandmother, who has sort of her own vision of the world, which is completely unrealistic with what he later comes to face. And I just thought Constant did that marvelously well. So that appealed to me greatly. And then, you know, obviously the book as a whole. But also, I mean, other aspects of it, not just that it's a book in translation, which is obviously something which always interests me, and my choices, I guess, tend to be works in translation because I just read a lot more of those, I'm more familiar with those. But surprisingly, this was an author who I had also been unfamiliar with, even though she's apparently very well known in France. She's won the Prix Goncourt, which is the big, big French literary prize. And even though the University of Nebraska Press and others have brought out several of her titles, this was actually the first one I had read. And it interested me, I mean, on the level, for example, that she's a successful author in France who even I haven't heard of in America and who doesn't seem to have been widely reviewed or that sort of thing. And also just the whole University of Nebraska Press series in which this appears, which I see as the European Women Writers Series. They do marvelous stuff, but very little of it, as far as I can tell, comes to the attention of the reading public, and so I'm always glad to be able to pick something like that.
How did you actually find this particular book, since it was so unknown and so obscure, or is it just sort of like, you know, come with the territory because you are the world literature king on the net, as far as I'm concerned?
Well, not quite, but fortunately, over the years, I've developed a bit of a relationship with the University of Nebraska Press and several other publishers who do concentrate on foreign fiction. And so they kindly do send me their catalog every I guess, 6 months, and I just fill out a form of the books that sound of interest. And fortunately, this had arrived before the time came to make the LBC choice, and of the books which I was weighing, it struck me as the most appealing. And the choosing to have it sent to me in the first place, it just I'll ask for almost any book in translation from them because they do have a very good track record, and I was glad this turned out to be a very good one.
What do you think could be done to get people to read more translated fiction? It's a bit of a crisis, so to speak, or depending upon who you talk with. What do you think could be done to get people to read or to get awareness out there, or is the LBC one of the answers?
I think the LBC is definitely one of the answers, and the whole, not just the LBC, but I think the whole literary blogging community, because it's sort of, I think the most important thing is to raise awareness that if people know the books are out there, then if the books sound of interest or are praised by people whose judgments they trust, then they'll go out and look for them. But I think the problem really is getting the awareness, and that's why, for example, I'm so frustrated by so many of these very, very good titles, which just don't receive any media coverage. And obviously, obviously the LBC or the literary bloggers as a whole, I think they fill a significant void there, and I think they are helping things out a lot.
Either that or more cheesecake shots of Chad Post.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Michael.
My pleasure.
So I am here with Betsy Wing, who is the translator of Paula Constant's White Spirit. Betsy, how are you doing today?
I'm well, thanks, Ed.
And so I wanted to actually ask how you got attached to this particular book. Were you approached, or did you actually find the title on your own? Have you actually translated other of Paula Constant's work?
Well, actually, Paula Constant asked me to translate it herself. It's one of her favorite books.
Mm-hmm.
I've translated two of her other books. The first one I found, basically, I was sent it by a press by Nebraska, who does a very good women writers in Europe series. And they sent it to me to see if I thought that it was worth their taking on as a translation, just in general, for anybody. And I wrote back and said, yes, this is a fantastic book, and I want to translate it. Don't give it to anybody else. And I got to do that one, and I loved that. That's the governor's daughter.
Okay.
And then Paul liked the translation. She understands English rather well and liked the translation, and she requested me as, quote, her translator. I don't know exactly what that means. It sounds like some sort of strange possession.
Maybe you're just the designated translator. Well, maybe we could sort of talk about how translators generally get a bad rap in terms of, like, you know, when a review is written of a book, people often sort of overlook the translator and the careful work it takes, which is almost, in and of itself, doing essentially, like, as arduous a process as actually writing a novel. Maybe you can talk about this.
Well, it is a little bit discouraging when, basically, I always read the reviews, and I always look for my name, of course, mm-hmm. and I haven't ever had my name associated with any bad adverbs, and when it's not even there, sometimes what it means to me is that this person didn't realize it was translated. And in some ways, that's a compliment.
Sure.
The people who are really conscious of the fact that a translator has been at work there will say something like a graceful translation or a, you know, felicitous. There are various things that they say to indicate that, you know, they know they're supposed to mention the translator, but it never is a subject of discussion.
Well, I talked to another translator named Jordan Stump, and he sort of said about his process for me in terms of how he breaks down a book and how he actually organizes it so that, oh, there's a dog there.
Oh, there certainly is a dog, and I'm hoping my daughter is going to run in the house and take him with her.
Okay, wait. Hey, I don't mind a little dog barking on this. It's always good to have a little bit of ambient noise, and I'm sure the dog's quite nice. But
he's a lovely dog, and he's going outdoors right now.
Oh, okay. Well, I hope he gets a good run. But going to the question here I was wanting to ask is, how do you go about starting a translated work? I mean, how do you break down a novel? Do you do these things in components? Do you do these things in one sort of mad rush forward, and then you kind of go back and tweak things later? What do you do to sort of get the kinds of finesse on the particular phrases so that you represent the author's voice as well as a faithful kind of translation to English?
Well, I have a dirty little secret, which I really didn't tell people for a long time until I read that Gregory Rabassa, who translates Garcia Marquez and does absolutely incredible translations, also works this way. I don't read the novel or whatever it is until I start to translate it.
Ah.
I go through as if I were discovering it, word by word. And I think that I think it keeps my language fresh, frankly. I then treat it as if I had written it. I go back very carefully and I rewrite it as if it were to be written, you know, in English, but a very peculiar English, because it is the English. It's the English that I could hear when I was listening to the author's voice. It's like you look at the words, you read the words, and they come in your eyes, and when you're lucky, they go out your fingers onto the page.
Gotcha.
It's very intuitive with me. I'm not academically trained. I have a good BA. I have fine background, learned plenty of French, read a lot, and I talked to a lot of very intellectual academic sorts. So I'm not, the language isn't foreign to me, but it's simply, it's not how I work. I think of myself as a writer, and I think of myself as, you know, almost collaborating with the other, the writer, the original writer. That's the excitement to me.
Sure.
I don't break it down into parts. I use dictionaries a lot. I'm not actually bilingual. Mm-hmm. I want to know every possible meaning of the words there. So as I go exploring through this book, I look up many, many words. I mean, of course, I don't look up if, and but anymore. But I do look up words which I might have a much more glib response to if I didn't look them up. And I think I love the slowing down of the pace of reading. Mm-hmm. I think that's what I like. I think of it as a sort of extreme reading.
Sure. Well, what do you do to sort of, you know, how do you decide upon what the perfect word is? And maybe from there we can also sort of talk about how you collaborated with Constance on this particular book. Were there many drafts? Maybe you can sort of elaborate on this.
Well, yes, there were probably 4 or 5 drafts. I don't engage the author that much at the beginning. I go through the book, and as I go through it, questions emerge, and I write them down to myself, and I mark them, and then I think that the book almost always solves those questions on its own. Almost everything that you need to know about a well-written book is there, as long as you've done your homework and you know a little bit about the time and the space and the ideas of the author. Then most of it is there, and I always put off asking an author until the very end. I know some people who translate actually treasure their contacts with the authors, but my experience has been that mostly they are engaged in their next work, not so much in something that they wrote 15 years ago, which is when usually things will be, you know, brought to attention here. For instance, Constance's book was written in 1989, and I guess, this is quite a bit later. 2006, and I guess she asked me to take it over in, you know, about 3 years ago. I usually also take the longest possible time, as much as the editor, and that's not just the American editor, but the French editor. When they sell the rights, they will specify that it has to be published in English by a certain date.
Yeah.
And I always ask that I have the longest possible time because I am going to write it and rewrite it, and then I'm going to ask my questions. And I don't think I have ever had a question that I've asked at the end change anything material in the text. A couple of times they've been, you know, I didn't know what a flower was or things like that. And most of my authors read English. One of them does not. He passed one of my translations on to his son, who was a young man learning English, and he was absolutely certain that I had everything wrong, absolutely everything wrong.
Well,
but I didn't, and I was a runner-up for a prize with that one, so I felt very pleased with myself.
Oh, yeah, well, translation is very hard work. Now, how did you, we were talking earlier about you being sort of Constance designated translator. How did you guys get hooked up, and how did you two get hooked up in the first place?
Well, basically because when I was sent that first book, which I translated as The Governor's Daughter by Nebraska, and said I wanted to translate it, then it was read by a lot of people who she knew, who said that it was a terrific translation. And would I please translate another I have done, which was translated as Trading Secrets, and then this one. Basically, it was just sort of, someone said, woman has done a good job with what you have written, and you must ask her to do another. So it was very simple. I've met Constance. I met her when I finished Trading Secrets. I met her. She lives in Aix-en-Provence, mm-hmm. where she's a professor. And she, at that point, asked me to do White Spirit.
Gotcha. Now, this book has a particular sort of working-class vernacular that's extremely sort of important to convey. Did you sort of consult anything in terms of dialects, or what did you do to sort of, you know, kind of reproduce that vernacular very faithfully?
Well, I'm a vernacular sort of a person.
Okay.
I don't know. I mean, I read all sorts of things. I think that it has to do with what your own exposure to written English, the various voices that it gives you that you can exploit, as well as, in fact, I've lived in the country. I've lived with people who were not very well educated. I've lived a lot of different ways, and I didn't find that voice hard. It didn't seem so difficult to me.
What about it did seem difficult to you in terms of White Spirit?
Well, the fact is, there was no way to deal with the major problem, which was the fact that first the title is in English. And then many of the words within the text are also in English. Mm-hmm. And it's important that they be in English. I couldn't just, you know, switch them back into French or change them into German or anything else. It was their Englishness, their American, not even English, American Englishness that was important. And there was nothing to be done about that except to mention that in a note at the beginning so that that this was something that was going on. It has a particular effect, those English words have a particular effect. French reader also, which was important. And that is that it was written in 89, as I said, and there's a great deal of resistance, and official resistance, to the use of Americanism in the French language. It had been going on, that had been going on officially for 15 or 20 years, and intellectuals, of course, resented that, many of them. Some of them did, some of them didn't, I suppose. But it sort of implies, the fact that they laugh at the Americanisms. They're happy with the Americanisms in that text. It makes them somehow, in a little ways, complicitous with the colonial project, which is being made a great deal of fun of in the book, or tragic fun of.
Yeah.
I mean, colonization is continuing on a different scale by different means. And the French reader, who reads a great deal, usually, they would have been against colonization. They would have been all in favor of pulling out of Africa and all of these other places. And yet, I don't know. There's something there that's a little bit strange in the fact that they have to read those words in English, American English, and so they have to be there. So that was the tone of that was difficult, and I'm not sure it was really solved because I couldn't translate them. I couldn't do anything other than note that they were there.
Sure.
So in a sense that's the failure of the translation, but nothing to be done about it.
Huh, that's really fascinating. Well, what were there any other aspects of this book that, you know, in terms of, like, a subtlety that was there in the French that you couldn't actually convey in the English, or that you actually found a workaround for so that actually it would be conveyed in English, or in a totally different sense?
Well, I think that what I had to work on the hardest, and it was a matter of tone, and I hope that I achieved it, was the sort of, when you come to the ending, all right, suppose that's a happy ending. Well, that's not a happy ending. That's a false happy ending. Mm-hmm. And you have to be able to let the irony come through. You have to let the sadness come through all of, the funny parts. They're all, as far as I'm concerned, heart-wrenchingly sad. And that bit of required a great deal of work. I don't know that I can particularly give any examples of funny book, but it's a very sad book. And in a sense, it ends with the monkey's scream in the park when he's left behind, when he's howling and left behind. That sense of abandonment is counteracted, perhaps, by the happy ending, but only superficially.
Sure. Now, how long did it take you to actually translate White Spirit?
It wasn't that long because the language was not that hard. But when I say not that long, I mean, it took me, 9 months to a year. I'm a writer, and I also try to do my own work. So I don't have a day job. I don't have to, teach. I know that what most translators do in order to maintain their standard of living, such as it is. But I don't have that problem so much, and I will devote, say, four hours a day to it, something like that. Huh. And then it still takes me a long time, because I do look things up, and I will look things up at every stage of the translation. I read it against the text, I read it alone, I read it back against the French. I don't involve anyone else in it. I know that some people are content or happy to read it back and have someone else listen to it, etc. But I basically, I trust my own ear and hope it works.
Do you often vacillate between a word or a sentence or an idiom in a manner? I kind of asked this question when I sort of bombarded you with a whole series of questions, but I wanted to get back to this notion of the right word or the right phrase to actually sort of convey this particular meaning. Or are you sort of someone who looks through these dictionaries and kind of pinpoints it immediately?
I would say that my real concern is that I not be glib, that I not come up with just the first thing that comes to mind. That's really part of why I use a dictionary, not so much because I don't have a perfectly good definition of the word, but because I know that for a French reader, there are going to be many more subtleties at play with every single word. And so when I have to put it into American English, I have to be careful to use words which also are as rich as possible. Now, with someone like Constant, it's a little bit difficult because she writes seemingly without any ostentatious, no wild metaphors, nothing strange, nothing. Her sentences are pretty well straightforward, and so you write a pretty well straightforward sentence in English. But every word is chosen so carefully, and she clearly loves the language. That's her drive. She loves the language like as much as she loves the details of the text. And so I have to, just lovingly choose a word which, for me, gives the closest approximation of tone. And, I really can only say that I think it is intuitive. It has to do with all the things that I have read in the past and hoping that I'm reading well in the present. And often, I guess that the changes, the largest changes that will happen to a word that I've chosen early, I'll think, it's a wonderful word, it's the perfect word here. Well, I'll go along in the text and I'll find that this really, that's my word, it's not her word. It really is not conveying what she set out to do. And so I'll have to go back and take out that beautiful word and put it someplace in a little notebook and save it for some other use.
Well, so I'm getting the sense then the translation for you is not something where you can actually sort of take an impulsive sort of approach. Does this kind of interfere with kind of getting a sort of voice of spontaneity, do you think? Do you have to sometimes go back and kind of re-examine this, something like this? Maybe you can sort of describe how, in what sense, is translation spontaneous?
Well, that's hard to say. I think that a spontaneous voice is rarely as spontaneous, no matter who the writer is, it's rarely as spontaneous as it seems to the reader. People who write, fairly straightforward fiction that's admired, Richard Ford, I mean, lots of people like that, they write and they rewrite and they rewrite and they rewrite, and finally it comes to the right point. And I think that that's the same way very much with translation, that spontaneity is it's an illusion. In fact, here's a wonderful story. Something that happened to me when I was translating. It was the first, well, probably the second or third thing I ever translated. And I was going great guns. I was looking at the words on the French page, and I was typing them out just crazy, and I wasn't looking much up anymore because you do get used to the writer's vocabulary, and you do sort of settle in on some words meaning pretty much always the same thing. I was just going along, and I usually limit myself to like 4 hours a day or so, and well, that day, it was just so great, and I was in a hurry. I had a deadline, and I was, like, approaching the seventh hour, and I had many pages translated, and I was so excited and pleased and proud. And so I stopped, and I said, okay, time to go cook supper, and I went back, and I looked at what I'd done. I had transcribed the last two pages. They were in French. I had just, you know, I'd just written it off in French, and I thought it was my best work.
Oh, wow.
Well, that much for spontaneity in translation.
Wow, talk about a linguistic sort of schizophrenia there.
Yeah, no, I was quite convinced it was my best work, and it probably was.
Well, I wanted to kind of talk with you, kind of bringing this to mind, is writing versus translating. You've written some things, and maybe you can sort of describe the different sort of sense that you get between the two forms.
Yes, I think I can, because I think that my great pleasure in translation, and it really is a great pleasure, I do love doing it, and that last flurry of excitement where I just transcribed it is kind of an example of perfect translation, but there's something about when you write with somebody else, you get to know what they know also. You're not just writing what you know. You're writing what they know. You're writing with them. You unlimit yourself in a certain way. I mean, perhaps it sounds like limitation. I think I read somewhere, maybe it was Mandelstam, Osip Mandelstam, who did a lot of translation to make a living. And he describes some of it as being like being a stenographer, and you sort of take down what the other person has written. You represent it. I don't really feel that way. I feel it's more of an exploration of the other person's thinking, and in a sense, a co-creation, maybe. That's the real pleasure. When I write for myself, I'm not a very, very imaginative writer. I write very much from my own experience. It's all fictionalized. And, you know, people whom I know would look at it and say, oh, it didn't happen that way, you know. But they would recognize the place or some incident or something like that. But I do feel limited by my own education, my own place in society, and I'm very curious about other parts of the world. I do think that I find that an exciting place to be.
Huh.
I guess in some ways I have a sort of a project, which is not to let English get stiff and glib in the way that it can get, which has to do with education of you know, people who are readers and writers and intellectuals. English can get as fixed and, you know, on its way to extinction as anything else. And I think letting other languages in and being a vehicle for that is very exciting. Mm-hmm. And I'm not quite able to do that myself as a writer. I think there are some writers who truly can. I'm not that caliber of an intellect, I think, but I can hear other voices, and I can help them, you know, spread into this language in a way that I think serves maybe both.
Well, here's an interesting question for you. You were mentioning in this last answer, like, you know, oh, it didn't happen that way at all. And I'm wondering if an author or a publisher has ever sort of approached you and sort of quibbled over the way that you sort of presented the nuances of a particular narrative. Have you had any kind of problems along these lines, or?
No, not really, not really. I think that those problems would be strictly personal.
Yeah. I guess most authors then seem to sort of basically let you run with the ball. That's what I'm getting at here.
Oh, yeah, yes. Basically, yes. And I think I'm extremely responsible to the author. One of the people whom I translate, Edouard Glissant, is a Martinican writer, and I admire his writing enormously. I think he's a great intellect, and he writes marvelous, marvelous books. And in a sense, their language stretches me much harder than Constance. But some of his stuff is really, really hard to translate. Mm. And he says to me, "Go ahead, just change it. Change it. Make it be something. Make it be something that works. Make it be writing that's going to work." And then, of course, I do. And then he looks at it and says, "Well, I didn't mean that." So. No, it comes and goes. I can have a certain kind of flight of fancy using my own language, but there are real limitations, and I have to, you know, maintain the responsibility to convey what the author, I think, really has in mind.
Gotcha. Now, I asked this question of Jordan Stump, and I was interested in getting it an answer from you, but I'm wondering, are there any French authors that you feel are being criminally under-translated in the English language? And as an adjunct to that question, I'd like to ask you, what can we do to sort of give translated fiction the respect that it's deserved, to point the way to people that there is more to translated fiction than Murakami?
Well, I have to admit that I'm not someone who reads very, very widely in contemporary French, because I find myself so intensely caught up in the translation projects that keep getting proposed, mm-hmm. that I have had very little chance to really explore. So I'm afraid I'm going to flunk that question. And as for the second part, a while back there was a movement afoot which was to make certain that translations got their due in the Times Book Review, the Village Voice, all sorts of things. This was back in the late 70s and the 80s. And a couple of times I benefited by there would be like a whole paragraph devoted to, you know, she does such and such, she does such and such, and this is fine. That seems to have sort of gotten forgotten. There was also, at the same time, a translator's contract, which was being proposed, whereby the translator had far more rights. It's frequently done as work for hire. In fact, almost always. In fact, you tend to make a lot more money if you do it as work for hire, because these books, no matter how good they are, unless they're, say, 100 Years of Solitude, basically don't sell that many, many, many copies. And so you sign on for like a, you know, first you get a down payment or whatever you call it, I forget, an advance, and then you get royalties of 4% or 7% or what you get over your advance. Well, only a very few times have any of the books that I've translated over these years gone beyond that advance, which is sometimes, you know, nice, but it sure would be hard to live on. So I don't know. I've gone back. In fact, some of the contracts now that are being offered, which are advance against royalties, are so measly. I mean, the advance, they'll give you $1,000 against the royalties, and, you know, my grandchildren might get something eventually, but not me.
Jeez.
So I've been doing more work for hire, which, of course, then, in a sense, unempowers the translator. I've lose control of the text. The ones that I have an advance and royalties on, the rights revert to me, and, you know, something conceivably could be done with them. If they made a nice movie or whatever, I would benefit somewhat. But I don't know what can be done except, you know, to let the word out that you really should spend a paragraph of a book review, of, you know, a full page, front page book review. You should say something about the translation. Now, the problem there, of course, is that the person who is reviewing it frequently has zero idea of the language, or if they do, they'll find something to pick on. That's another very common thing, is that when people like to talk about translators, they like to say, oh, well, you know, they did this, and this is, you know, this isn't what it says. I can read this perfectly well. It doesn't say this. So, you know, it's a real problem, and I'm not sure how soluble it is.
Well, maybe if we put the translator's name on the spine of the book. I mean, I'm looking here at White Spirit, and it says Constant White Spirit, Constant. If it said Constant Wing, maybe this is the answer. I don't know. It's kind of, it actually...
Oh, you actually, I always do fight for it. My name is on the cover. It's on the front cover.
Yeah, it is on the front cover, yes, but...
Well, it isn't on the spine. You're right. It's not Constant Wing. And that would be an interesting thing, because there are differences between translations over the years. I mean, Constance Garnett's War and Peace. So you'd have War and Peace, Tolstoy, Garnett. And that would be, you know, you'd want to know that when you went to buy it.
Yeah, or Quixote Grossman, you know?
Yeah, precisely. Precisely. Yeah. Now, you know, I guess maybe I'm dealing in fiction that people are not predicting a long, long future for. But who knows? You never know what the future will bring.
Well, I wanted to go back to what you were saying earlier, because I wasn't aware of this movement you mentioned. I was a young rapscallion at the time, but you were talking about the Times Book Review and there being a movement, I guess, under the John Leonard days to pay attention to translators. What was this exactly? I'm really curious. I'm going to have to look this up.
It was certainly not started by the Times Book Review. It was started by the American Literary Translators Association.
Okay.
Who began to sort of... They were beginning to get themselves together into a more powerful group. It's a fairly large group now and full of very, very interesting translators and of all sorts of languages, and they do a review and all that sort of thing. And they simply began to protest, and they began circulating this model contract, and they began to write letters. And they wrote letters saying, you know, don't you really think that you should mention such and such and such and such, that so-and-so translated this book, and that it give it some credit. But it didn't. You know, people get tired. It's kind of almost like writing your senator about something you know perfectly well he's never going to change.
Yeah.
And I think that it just sort of fell by the wayside. If someone who translates does a review, you'll almost always find mention of it because they understand the work that's gone into it. And truly, I often think that when it's not mentioned, it's because they think that this text was born and bred in English, that it just happened, which is in some ways a compliment. So at least you're not being told that you should have translated this way, this way, and this way, which is another tactic.
Well, Bessie, I have to say you've given me some ideas for a leaflet campaign here.
Oh, good. Well, I, you know, in a lot of ways, I think, you know, communicating with the people that you do with your blog is a terrific way to, in fact, increase the consciousness about the work the translators do. A lot of the work that we do read these days are in translation. I think we're all hungry for news of the outside world, and so a lot of it is translation. More notes should be taken of it.
Well, I have to agree with you. Well, anyway, Betsy, thank you very much. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
Well, thanks a lot.